Did you know we have completely ad-free early access to all of our episodes? Well, we do. Not only that, but we have dozens of bonus episodes waiting for you. Head on over to patreon.com/ghosttownpod, and you can check it out for 7 days absolutely free. That's patreon.com/ghosttownpod.
A dark future. I'm Jason Horton.
I'm Rebecca Lieb.
And this is Ghost Town.
In April of 2006, 17-year-old Richard Kelly, a troubled teen and a young gang member from Limerick, Ireland, went missing. Panicked, Richard's mother sought the assistance of Dennis McKenzie, a clairvoyant who does pro bono psychic reads for missing persons. When McKenzie meditated on the case, he saw a vision, Richard's body with a concrete slab beside it, next to a bridge. The words Brigid and Bodike kept appearing for McKenzie, though he didn't know what they meant. That is, until a fisherman on Lake Bridget, near Bodike, County Clare, discovered something horrifying. Tangled underneath his net was a limb attached to what he thought was a body. Sure enough, divers recovered the remains of Richard Kelly the following day. Concrete slabs and rope were found affixed to Kelly's body. 5 men were arrested, the murder an act of retaliation after Kelly had stolen a car belonging to an opposing local gang. Dennis McKenzie's haunting premonitions had seemingly come true, just in time to solve Kelly's homicide. Though incredibly controversial, the use of psychics, mediums, and clairvoyance to help solve criminal investigations is not entirely uncommon. It's prevalent, even. I used to work on a show a couple years ago with a CSI writer who had once been a sheriff in LA County. She herself admitted, someone who is a skeptic, that they used psychics when they were in a bind. Of course, the government has tested psychic capabilities for years as well. We did an episode on the Stargate Project a while back. And while skeptics, again, abound, psychics and those they've helped will swear upon certain unseen powers and abilities, helping bring heinous crimes to justice. Complicated, fascinating, and hard to explain, let's at least dig in a bit and try. Today we're talking about some cases solved, at least in major part, with the help of psychics. In 1961, a famous Dutch psychic, or psychometrist as he preferred to be called, named Gerard Croisset, was enlisted by New York detectives to help locate a missing 4-year-old girl named Edith Kikorius. Croisset had been helping Northern European law enforcement catch criminals for years, simply by intuiting information from evidence. In fact, by the 60s, he was a celebrity, studied by scientists and called, quote, the man with the X-ray mind. Police would place an object from the crime scene, usually covered or wrapped up, in the psychic's hands, and he would get visions of the crime as it was committed, and often visuals of the criminal. On February 25th, 1961, Croisset began a series of transatlantic phone calls with NYPD to find Kikorius. Although Croisset was invited to the U.S. to do his psychometry work in-house, he deliberately chose not to, feeling he would, quote, choke on all the impressions he would receive. So, from the Netherlands, he started his work. Despite never having been to New York or even America, Croisset was at first clearly able to identify streets and buildings. As his work, I say work because I'm not exactly sure what else to call it, became more in tune, Croisset's images became numbers, lines, and faces. Soon Croisset told officials that he had pinpointed the exact spot where the girl was. But, he was sorry to say, she had passed away. Police leapt on this information and found Kikorius's body exactly where Croisset said it would be. Based on a description of a face Croisset gave to officials, Kikorius's murderer was soon discovered, arrested, and committed to a hospital for the criminally insane. Meanwhile, Croisset's gifts were continually tested throughout his life. One method for determining psychic abilities that a lot of researchers used was called the chair test. During the test, a psychic looks at a seating plan and selects a random chair number. Once the chair is selected, the psychic provides specific details about the next future individual who will sit in that selected chair. It's pretty interesting. Croisset took this test, providing his answers on paper, which were sealed in an envelope until the chairs were filled with people. After everyone had had a seat, his writing was compared to the individual in his selected chair, and researchers were impressed. They said that Croisset had, quote, remarkable success in providing specific and accurate details. Despite his A pluses on his many chair tests in different countries, the Belgian Committee for the Scientific Investigation of Phenomena Reputed to be Paranormal, that's a long name with lots of clauses, also looked into Croisette and found no evidence of him having psychic ability at all. Despite this, Croisette died in Utrecht in 1980 at 71 years old, still incredibly successful. So much so that Gerard Jr., his son, is also a practicing psychic. On December 15, 1981, 31-year-old Melanie Uribe went missing on the way to her job at Pacoima Hospital in Burbank, California, when the dependable single mother never showed up at the hospital and investigation commenced. Witnesses questioned said they saw two men forcing their way into the truck of a woman who fit the description of Uribe while she was waiting at a stoplight. The next morning, Burbank police found Uribe's pickup truck and a discarded nurse's uniform. Uribe's disappearance became front-page news, so it was no wonder when a 32-year-old shipping clerk at Lockheed Aerospace was alerted to the case by a coworker. Having no knowledge of Uribe aside from some light water cooler talk, Etta Smith heard a strong voice inside her head saying, "She's not in the house." As soon as the thought crossed her mind, Smith had a powerful vision, a canyon and a curving road, brush, a mountainous backdrop, and a dirt path leading to something white. Despite not even considering herself a psychic, Etta Smith felt strongly that her vision was tied to Melanie Uribe's whereabouts. She left work early that day to describe her experience to the police. The police, of course, were skeptical, but nothing about Etta Smith seemed unreliable. She was an intelligent person, trusted with top security clearance. Why not hear her out? Using a map, Etta pinpointed the area where she believed Uribe's body would be found, a remote part of the San Fernando Valley called Lopez Canyon. Smith was sure she was there, even fighting off her own urges to go find her. But those urges got larger when the police didn't seem to jump on her tip. That same day, she took some family members with her to Lopez Canyon and felt the presence of Melanie Uribe there, though she couldn't find anything herself. It was dark, after all, and she didn't really know what she was feeling, just going with it, for now. In the light of day, Etta Smith and her daughter drove back to the canyon. She felt the same way she did during her first visit, but this time she knew would be different. This time around, Smith noticed fresh tire tracks, and her intuition pulled her further down into the canyon. As the two kept moving, Smith's daughter noticed something strange in the brush. White nursing shoes that they then found were attached to a body. It was all there. Canyon, curving road, brush, mountains, dirt path, to something white. An autopsy identified the body found by Smith's daughter as Melanie Uribe's. But Smith's assistance didn't make her a hero. No, far from it. Now she was a suspect. For several hours, Etta Smith was questioned by detectives who made her take a polygraph test. She passed it. However, the detectives told her that she had failed it, trying desperately to get answers out of the confused woman. Police thought that if she wasn't the killer, her information was coming from somewhere. They thought that maybe selling her grandiose vision story could earn her some money. The next morning, Smith was arrested for the murder of Melanie Uribe and held barefoot in a cell for 24 hours without food or water. Detectives were certain she would break and admit to the murder since they couldn't explain her visions. Meanwhile, 17-year-olds Lewis Carnell Morgan and Spencer Nelson, who were driving the truck witnesses reported seeing, had been bragging about killing a woman after apprehending her vehicle. Talk gets out fast, and after their arrest, both teenagers confessed to the killing. Etta Smith was released on December 21, 1981, and following her mistreatment, won a lucrative civil lawsuit against the Los Angeles Police Department. In 1983, Illinois law enforcement publicly thanked a psychic named Greta Alexander. Quote, "I was skeptical to begin with," said Alton Detective William Fitzgerald, "but I guess I'm going to have to be a believer now." Once a housewife and a mother in rural Illinois, the psychic profession kind of found Greta Alexander in a big way. While pregnant with her fifth child, a bolt of lightning struck her room. Although she believed she was an intuitive person since childhood, Alexander said the lightning incident is what jump-started her psychic abilities, bringing her to her full potential. Soon, she turned her new talents into a full-fledged career. In April, Alexander was called by police to help find the body of 27-year-old Mary Cousset. Cousset was last seen with her boyfriend, Stanley Holliday Jr., who was arrested and would later confess to her murder. But the big problem with the investigation was that law enforcement couldn't find Cousset's body. Enter Greta Alexander, who gave the police 22 specific clues that police used to find Mary's skeletal remains. Fitzgerald said Alexander predicted the location of the body, its condition, and the way it would be found. He said she even predicted it would be found by a man, quote, "with a bad hand," and that the initial S would be important to the discovery. On October 29th, 1983, Mary Cousset's body was discovered, stabbed to death near Peoria, Illinois, by policeman Steve True, who incidentally had a deformed hand. Of course, many reports say that law enforcement didn't mention Alexander's predictions that had not come true. For example, Cousset's body had been found far from the area Alexander had initially circled. Despite her critics, she would continue her work with the police and community. She died in 1998. I am not a psychic myself, but I see something very important in our future. A break.
Hi, hello, how are you?
Hello.
We're checking in.
Here we are, checking in.
We're doing
with
it.
With you.
Yeah.
How are you feeling?
Yeah.
I'm feeling a little congested, I'm not going to lie to you. Maybe you can hear it. I want to say I'm sorry. Doing my best.
I feel optimal.
Wow, okay.
Completely optimized.
Got it. Good, good, good. Yeah. Excellent. Yeah. Jason's never felt better.
Yeah.
And so. I'm just at a plodding along mediocre. Great. That's
you put
that's
us together,
right.
You get Ghost Town, baby.
Woo.
We want to say hello to anyone who's listening, anyone sharing the pod, spreading the word.
Absolutely.
Absolute domination. Scorched earth.
That's what this looks like?
Yeah.
Damn.
And we appreciate the army.
That's
of
always.
People.
Always.
That's how some people talk, right? Hey, want to say what's up to the Ghost
my
Town army?
My army.
What's up to the Ghost Town army?
That's, yeah, that's yeah. Great. That's yeah. A people do talk a lot about like worldwide, like a movement.
Yeah, this is not that.
No, this is really more of a nap.
Well, it's one movement I can think of.
Ooh. Wow, wow. Coming in hot.
Yep.
Oh, God.
We're a real zoo crew right here.
Put me out of my misery.
You know what'll make you feel better?
Tell me.
A little politic talk. Let's go to the politics corner.
That will make me feel better.
We want to say hello to our mayors. And as a reminder, if you are in the government, you could always say, hey, there's something I want to mention to the masses, whether it's a podcast of your own, a charity that you feel strongly about. You want to wish somebody a happy birthday.
Honestly, please do that. Please.
If I knew there was other podcasts like ours that would let me be part of that and I could do that every week so I could just promote Ghost Town or like my book or something like that, I would absolutely do it. And no one takes advantage of it. You want to know why? Because they are just altruistic people that are just want to support.
They're just kindly people who just enjoy what they're listening to. I mean, I've been in LA too long.
Yeah.
I don't know. I don't know what to do with
What's your game, mayors? Really? What's your angle?
I know.
But just as a reminder, that's a perk of this. And I don't know. I think it's a very valuable perk.
Yeah. And it also lengthens the length of the podcast.
Yeah. Which is great.
We both appreciate.
And somebody that could bend spoons with her mind.
Great.
Ashley Mattson.
Hello.
A little someone who can levitate. Charlie Gilbert.
Hello.
And someone who could walk through walls.
Damn, that's good.
And does.
Of course.
Kat Joselle.
Hello.
And I'm wearing a t-shirt that Kat got me at the Outsiders House Museum in Tulsa. What up to them? Check them out.
Damn, Kat, where's my shirt?
But here's the thing, Rebecca. What's you have to be an outsider.
I mean,
you're a globalist. Yeah, you're
a
globalist.
Oh, man.
It's only for outsiders. Now, she was, I mean, I'm going to, because I wore this, showed the shirt on Instagram. So, but she was there visiting the museum and Danny O'Connor, who's, if you remember, House of Pain.
Yeah.
And he's just really into cultural history. The movie The Outsiders, he bought the house that's in the movie.
Whoa.
And it's now, it's a museum. It's very cool. It's in Tulsa. Definitely check it out. And he's in my first book. He's got a anecdote in my first book. I have two books out. Somebody
that
please,
makes sense.
Somebody
makes
please
sense.
Get one.
That's a gift that's germane to your interests and your work. I get it. That being said, if anyone wants to get me a gift, I'm open to that.
She also wrapped it in a brand new iPad.
She bent an iPad around the shirt.
Yeah, it was just kind of like wrapped around.
Wow,
it. Yeah,
you're like, that's weird.
Yeah, that's germane to my interests is Apple products. And someone who can both create and destroy on a cellular level.
Holy shit.
Beyond limitless is our governor, who could just crush life as we know it with one thought, but chooses not to.
She doesn't want to.
Avian Noble. So if you want no ads, no chit-chat, bonus episodes, you want to binge, you don't want to hear stuff like this, you just want to get to the good or bad stuff, depending, head on over to patreon.com/ghosttownpod.
Incredible. Let's get back into it. And we are back. I have three more psychic investigations to share with you. We're going to keep going with a case about a woman named Maria Scott. So 4 years after the murder of 27-year-old Maria Scott went cold, a psychic named Debbie Malone was brought in to help. In the early 2000s, Scott lived at Tribal Care Farm Youth Rehabilitation Center in the Southern Highlands. While she had previously struggled with drugs, the 27-year-old sex worker was trying to get her life on track. On March 24th, 2003, she suddenly went missing. On October 30th of that year, teenage residents found Scott's decomposing body wrapped in a quilt and dumped in the bushlands on the grounds of Tribal Care Farm. She had been stabbed twice in the chest, twice in her abdomen, and once in the back. Scott's body was so badly decomposed that police set her time of death anywhere between 2 months and a year before she was found. Inundated with false leads, or perhaps because she was an Aboriginal sex worker, low-priority victims historically in the hierarchy of investigations, the case went cold. For 4.5 years, Scott's frustrated friends and family hoped justice would be served. But the investigation took a turn when Debbie Malone stepped in. According to the Daily Telegraph, Malone had caught the attention of Detective Jeffrey Little, one of the investigators put on Scott's case, when he watched her appearance on the psychic investigation television show, Sensing Murder. Little gave Malone a bangle that had been found on Scott's body. Holding the object, Malone gave details about the location of the murder and kept seeing a drain pipe. Inspecting the drain pipes around Tribal Care Farm, authorities found a knife, one that was eventually proven to be the weapon that took Scott's life. Malone also told detectives that she could feel the spirit of the killer inside her. She said the killer themselves were dead, because only ghosts embodied her in that way. This revelation confirmed authorities' suspicions that Mark Brown, a neighbor of Tribal Care Farm with a violent past, had been the killer, since he had died by suicide 4 years before. Quote, "Her description of what happened was so close to what we had found, I included it in the coroner's brief. I don't know whether he took any notice of it, but she was brilliant. She told us how the body was positioned in the bush, where it was found, and what Maria was wearing," Little said, via the Daily Telegraph. Adding, "What we hadn't told her was the key suspect had actually died by suicide. I was extremely skeptical at first, but then I couldn't explain how she knew these things, when all we gave her was a bangle." On August 11, 2005, 20-year-old Ohio State College student Julie Popovich pre-gamed at a friend's apartment and headed out to the university district with some friends to continue their evening. Popovich, a waitress and sometimes model, met a man named Adam Saleh at one of the bars. Witnesses at the bar testified that Popovich was drunk and dancing. She was last seen about 1:15 a.m., leaving with Saleh. Though Saleh insisted he left alone, Popovich was reported missing the next day. Saleh was eventually arrested and convicted, and yet, Popovich's body was never found. 3 weeks after she went missing, a Michigan-based psychic named Christy Robinette was randomly visited by a soul of a young woman from Ohio. Confused, Robinette found out Julie was in dire straits. According to the psychic, quote, "Julie pushed her way through the other spirits waiting to speak with me and asked me to draw a map, the map of where her body would be found." Police carried out the operation as directed by Robinette and were immediately led to Popovich's corpse. Popovich's murderer, Adam Saleh, received 38 years to life in prison by the Franklin County Courts. Of course, lots of government entities have tried to harness these innate psychic abilities and have failed. In the 70s, the CIA and DIA were obsessed with having a leg up on Soviet technologies, which included psychics and remote viewing capabilities. Various programs throughout the 70s, 80s, and 90s, like Stargate, it's itself the basis of the movie The Men Who Stare at Goats, and a past topic of a Ghost Town episode, were approved and heavily funded. Accordingly, in the 1979 study, Evaluation of the Use of Psychics in the Investigation of Major Crimes, 12 psychics were essentially put through the ringer. They were each given 4 crimes, 2 solved and 2 unsolved. Physical evidence from each of the 4 crimes were placed in sealed, numbered envelopes. Each psychic was asked to provide information about the contents of the sealed envelopes and any other information that kind of came to them. Then the psychics opened the envelopes, examined the evidence, and gave more information. None of the psychics, of course, had any knowledge of the cases detailed in those envelopes. Although this experiment is very cool, in my opinion, it was found inconclusive. Quote, "The research does not support the contention that psychics can provide significant additional information leading to the solution of major crimes. But if you're interested, as I was, the area of greatest accuracy involved the sex of the suspect and that of the victim. Some degree of accuracy was also detected in the type of crime committed." But let's get back to David McKenzie, the psychic from the beginning of our episode. McKenzie was put on the Soham murders, a hugely high-profile case of two girls missing in Soham, England. On August 4th, 2002, 10-year-old Jessica Chapman went to a barbecue at the home of her best friend, Holly Wells, in nearby Red House Gardens, close to Soham. The girls played at Holly's and, for fun, took a photograph together wearing Holly and her brother's Manchester United replica football shirts. That was around 5:04 p.m. Around 6:15, they left to buy some candy from a vending machine at a local sports center. While returning to Holly's, the girls walked past the home of Ian Huntley, the groundskeeper at their middle school. Huntley told the girls that his girlfriend, their teacher, was there, and that she said hello. And then, the girls are never seen again. At 8 p.m. that night, the girls are not back at Holly's or Jessica's homes. They're reported missing at around 10 p.m. that night. The disappearance hits newsstands the next day, and it is again a huge case from the get-go. Over 400 officers were assigned full-time to search for the girls, scouring Soham and investigating the many sightings residents had had of them all over the city, even questioning over 250 registered sex offenders across the UK. The photo of the two girls in the football shirts are broadcast everywhere. It is a haunting photo, taken just 2 hours before they disappeared. Weeks go by and there are no leads, so the authorities call in David McKenzie. McKenzie says he will help, and he does, but he tells UK police that he has bad news. He says that the girls were dead and that a man and a woman, whom he was able to describe to law enforcement in great detail, were involved. Quote, "I described the caretaker, Ian Huntley, who would be convicted of the murders, and his girlfriend, Maxine Carr," he says. "I also described the view from Huntley's house, his red Fiesta, the Fenland Road he drove along to dispose of the bodies, and the site where he dumped them." On August 17th, 13 days after they go missing, the bodies of Jessica Chapman and Holly Wells are found lying side by side in a ditch, more than 10 miles east of Soham. Ian Huntley, the guy who last saw the girls, is also participating in the investigation, searching with people and asking police way too many questions. He's been questioned with his girlfriend, but both have witness statements and valid alibis. But others witnessed Huntley's girlfriend, Carr, in a different place than her alibi, and their stories quickly crumble. That same day, Ian Huntley and his girlfriend, Maxine Carr, are arrested. Huntley then refuses to answer questions, feigns confusion, even drools in an attempt to seem mentally ill, so he's sent to a hospital. Carr, on the other hand, has a different approach and admits that she lied in her alibi statement to support her boyfriend. But then they find Huntley's fingerprints on some of the children's clothes in a trash can found later that day, and Huntley's fate is sealed. Huntley was found guilty on 2 counts of murder and sentenced to a minimum of 40 years. Carr pleaded guilty to the charge of perverting the course of justice and was found not guilty of assisting an offender. Carr was sentenced to serve 3.5 years in prison for perverting the course of justice. Dennis McKenzie wrote a book about his work and does not charge for his services. In fact, a lot of these psychics that we talked about today, they charge $40-$50 or not at all, and certainly not at all when they are involved in helping investigations. In McKenzie's own words, he says, quote, "I'm just an ordinary bloke and I hope I'm doing some good with the gift I've been given. For me, it's all about putting myself at the service of others. I truly believe that helping people is, in itself, its own reward." Skeptics abound, of course, and yet we continue to use these special people, mechanisms, however you want to call them, in our search for answers.
I think it's great that it's pro bono work, and that he has a book. Do you know what I mean? Don't.
Yeah.
Listen, come on.
I knew when I was writing this episode, I was like, Jason is going to hate this.
I mean, I love this subject.
Sure.
In fact, just in the last like week or two, I was like really looking into hot readings and cold readings. Mm-hmm. We know, we've seen from evangelists to psychics, and how people get and find information. If you say guess a number from 1 to 10, and you give me 8 tries, mm-hmm. might get it right.
Yeah.
Right? And then you're like, wow. And then also, a lot of these things is people will get things right, and the things that did not get right don't mm-hmm. end up in like a broadcast.
Yeah,
a lot
of course. These exactly.
famous psychics, and I believe that there's people out there that know that they're being deceptive. They know it. They're going yeah. into it being deceptive. I think there's other people that may start going into it and being like, I do really feel I have something, mm-hmm. and then become deceptive because it becomes their
thing. It's their
becomes
shtick.
Their thing.
Yeah.
And then I think there are people that truly believe that they are, and they're being honest with what they think. Mm-hmm. What is actually happening is the skeptic in me. And obviously, but people become very desperate in a lot of ways. Everyone's looking for answers.
Totally.
It's whether you're praying to a god, or like you're wishing on nature, or putting a penny in a fountain. It's all part of that. And interesting, like in the last maybe like 7 days, I said I was going to mention this on Ghost Town. Actually, this is like the perfect episode to do it.
Ooh.
I have a friend that you go back many years back in New York. He's a huge music person. He's got like a record store and he sells, right? He's like he's just somebody I talk to about music, and I'll bring up a band and be like, what do you think about them now? Let's mm-hmm. go back. Like now that you've had the internet and time mm-hmm. Does it still hold up? And I'll do that every once in a while, like once every 2 months. Uh-huh. And for some reason, a band will pop into my head and I'm like, what do you think of that? So I texted him, which uh-huh. again, we don't text that much. It's not like I do it every day where it could eventually, I'm going to pick things that he's listening to. But I was like, what do you think now of Neutral Milk Hotel, right?
Yeah.
So I picked that just out of, just, you know, I go in these things. I was like, yeah, like let me look back on them. Mm-hmm. And he's like, that's so weird. I'm listening to them right now.
That's wild.
He's like, that's so weird. And I was mm-hmm. like, I'm a psychic, and I'm going to tell people on Ghost Town, I'm a psychic. Again, that is a
It's a coincidence. I mean, what a coincidence.
It's a huge,
you know, huge coincidence.
Now, again, it's not outside of the purview of the kind of music we listen to. It's not like I picked like something that I would have never brought up before, and it's something that I would never think to ask somebody. Mm-hmm. So it's still within that world, but it's one of a few, maybe thousands of bands or
yeah,
whatever.
Yeah, totally.
And I thought that was kind of odd, and I didn't have a weird feeling about it. I was just like, this is what I want to ask him about. I knew he'd have an answer whether he was listening to them or not, mm-hmm. but I thought it was just like a really odd coincidence in the many odd coincidences or strange happenings I've had.
Yeah.
Even as a cynic, like I push away from, I've had
no,
weird things.
And you have more weird things than I think you care to admit right. as a skeptic. I believe that people are connected in a lot of different mm-hmm. ways and energy. Again, I think a lot of psychics are fucking selling yeah. you a bill of goods, and I've certainly
been
sold.
And people have premonitions, and yeah. I think those are real. There's something out there that's not exactly science or
yeah,
facts.
There's something that connects us. Sure. Humans are connected somehow that in a way that we can't quantify yet. Maybe we will someday. Maybe we won't. I don't know. But I think that there is some kind of connective tissue, this fiber that we don't see, and the way that's expressed is different. And that's kind of like why we can't like scientifically process people when people have like a crazy vision, and they're like, because if I had a vision that you were gonna fucking die in a car crash tomorrow, I would be like, I need to say this thing, because if I don't say this thing, but if it happened, like then I knew this thing. Of course, like we're all kind of like pushed to help and to support and to like be involved, and I think there's a lot of like altruism and like pure of heart kind of ideology around that. But then it gets into this sort of thing where it's like, okay, once that builds and builds, is it now your main line of work? Are you now profiting from it? And I want to say that like a lot of these people don't make money off of the stuff that they do for these cold cases and when they're involved in investigations. So that's a good thing, I think. And I think it brings a lot of comfort to the victims' families, if I'm sure. being super honest.
People do like to be involved, though.
They absolutely do.
People do like to be part of things. It's yeah, it's altruism, but it's not totally. I think people like to
insert themselves.
People like to but also people like to help, you know.
Yeah, oh
people,
yeah.
People like, you know, you feel good about feeling useful. There is something to
totally.
That. I understand
that's very
that.
Human as well.
Absolutely a lot, but also there is a equity in a lot of things. Like, yeah, I do all this stuff for, you know, lawyers do pro bono work on huge cases mm-hmm. and small cases for free all the time mm-hmm. and there's a benefit to that.
Totally. There's some optics to that. Absolutely.
Sure.
Absolutely. Wait, let's get back to the point. And the point is, when you psychically connected to your friend,
yes.
what did he say about Neutral Milk Hotel?
Oh, he says at least that second album still holds up. And Jeff Magnum lives near where he lives, close to where I live and used to live in New York.
Oh.
So he's kind of a weirdo, but a nice guy. You know, just kind of looking back, if they made another album, would that have, people always wonder, like, what would that third album be?
Yeah.
But is it part of the lore of the fact that it's just a huge question mark? This band that was like, had this really huge album, maybe not even so much then, but definitely now. It's like, you look back on it, it's probably on every single music album in the Airplane Over the Sea, which is a great.
Incredible.
I'll tell you another interesting thing about that.
Yeah.
When that came out, I was kind of like not, I was just very, whatever was going on with me, I was just like very pushed, like I was just like, I pushed that kind of stuff away because I thought it was people trying to be cool. Like, that was my stupid hang-up.
Well, it's in the vernacular of, like, you know, post-punk kind of indie, whiny, like, I get that.
And it took probably that album came out, like, 1998. And I was like, I heard it, whatever. In probably, like, 2007 or 2008, a girl I was dating at the time who, looking back, I was like, I didn't really think didn't really seem to like that kind of music, but really like Neutral Milk Hotel, at least that album, and put it on. I was like, oh yeah, this is really good. But yeah, I just, for some reason, I was thinking about them and I was like, hey, tell me what, you know, let's go back and tell me what you think about this now, having the benefit of kind of time elapsing. Does it hold up? Does it not hold up? Is it as important as everyone makes it out to be? But he was like, that was really weird that you brought that up. And I said, I'm just an outsider wearing an outsider's t-shirt.
Who published two books.